Welcome to Still Scared, Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Webray, and today we're talking about the 1974 novel House of Stairs by William Sleater. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! So, we teased this a fair bit in the last episode. This is House of Stairs by William Sleater, the second in our William Sleater exploration. I don't know if we're going to do any more, but...
Not for now. Maybe sometime in the future.
Yeah. So, I'll give a little description. The plot?
Please do.
The summary is, 5 16-year-old orphans of wildly varying personality characteristics are involuntarily placed in a house of endless stairs as subjects for a psychological experiment on conditioned human response. That's essentially the plot. So they're in this mysterious building that's made up entirely of blank white staircases. The only feature is a sort of mysterious machine that flashes and produces food when they perform certain action, and the actions that it demands become increasingly complex until the machine requires that they turn on each other to receive food. Two of the group end up rebelling and decide to starve themselves rather than participate in this, but the other three become increasingly inhumane and vindictive as they are thoroughly conditioned by the machine. And then at the end it's revealed that they're part of this psychological experiment to produce a elite and ultra-obedient group of teenagers to do the government's dirty work, essentially.
Yeah.
Should I just introduce our characters as well?
Sure, yeah.
So Peter is the first character we meet, and he's kind of dreamy and gentle and sort of seems quite weak, but then he's the one who turns out to actually incite the sort of rebellion against the machine. Lola is kind of confident and aggressive, and she's most convinced of the sinister nature of where they are from the beginning, and she joins Peter in rebelling. Blossom is greedy and manipulative and set against Lola from the beginning, and she's from an upper class background. Abigail is meek, elegant, easily manipulated, in thrall of Oliver, and Oliver is a confident, charming, wants leadership of the group, prone to manipulation and aggression when aggrieved. They're all 16 and they're all orphans. So did you want to explain a little bit about the classical conditioning that sort of is a central theme of the book?
So, as you said, all of the characters are enthralled to this machine which produces food pellets. And the book is basically William Sleater's response to B.F. Skinner's book Beyond Freedom and Dignity, which is an amazingly sinister name for a scientific treatise, which was published in 1971 and explained Skinner's theories of classical conditioning. So most of you will probably be familiar with Pavlov and his dogs. The classical conditioning basically works through associated stimuli, creating so for instance, for Pavlov's dogs, Pavlov found supposedly that his dogs would salivate at the smell of food, so their freshly cooked food, and then he would ring a bell to coincide with the preparation and the giving of this food, and then found that eventually he could ring the bell and the dogs would salivate at the sound of the bell because they had learnt to associate the sound of the bell with the arrival of the food. And this is called classical conditioning, so it's using positive or negative stimuli in order to reinforce behaviour, essentially. And this is the kind of conditioning that's used by the machine. So basically, at its most simple, the kids get fed when they do what the machine wants them to do. And they have to sort of intuit what the machine wants, sort of by trial and error. And also, I don't know, they start to get a kind of rhythmic feel for it. So they have to at first do quite a simple dance. And as you said, this dance kind of increases in complexity until it becomes quite highly ritualised. Mm. And then eventually this is kind of replaced by an implied injunction to be violent and cruel towards each other. And as you said, two of them resist and the other three go along with it.
Yeah, there's quite a detailed description of the dance in all its complexity. I don't know if we should read a little bit of it to show sort of what they're doing.
Sure, do you have it excerpted?
Yes, I think I've got the page here. Okay. At this particular moment, their dance went like this. Lola and Blossom, opposite one another, circled slowly around the hole in the landing. Their arms were extended above their heads, swaying from side to side, hands outstretched. As each one reached the point nearest the edge, she would spin around quickly, timing it so that the spin occurred at every other flash of light, and at the moment of spinning, each would raise her head and emit a high-pitched wail. At the same time, Peter and Abigail, timing their movements precisely to the flashing light, performed a complex series of movements on two adjacent stairways, bowing to the landing, rising to their toes and waiting for a flash with their hands on their hips and their chins lifted, turning, lifting a leg behind and bending to touch a stair above with both hands, waiting for a flash, turning, moving quickly down to the landing to meet Oliver, waiting for a flash, then back up on the steps, where the pattern would begin again. And Oliver in the centre of it all, moved alone. He would begin between their two stairways, stretching, his back arched, then suddenly leap, landing on a flash of light and just missing Lola as she passed, landing with one foot in the air and spinning around instantly to begin a swaying, hip-moving walk, his arms held before him, his hands and wrists twining and intertwining, his head bending towards one shoulder and then the other as he moved towards the stairs, there to meet, one every other time, Abigail or Peter. It was always Abigail the first time. He would reach her, grasp her about the waist, and with her body arched she would fall backwards, her hands brushing the floor, until the right moment, Oliver would pull her up to him, and he would step away to begin again. At the next repetition it would be Peter.
And instead of Pavlov's bell kind of preceding the dance comes a kind of auditory announcement or alarm. And what I thought was a nice touch, or an interesting touch, is that each of the characters hear it differently. So they each interpret the voice that they hear, this alarm, as saying something different. So yeah. Can I read out the different interpretations?
Oh, yeah, go for it.
So, "I know," Blossom cried. "They're saying food will be coming soon. Food will be coming soon. Listen, can't you hear it?" Her eyes were darting wildly, and she clasped her hands together. "Oh, I hope they're right. I hope they're telling the truth. It's been so long since we've had any food." "Shh," said Lola, waving her hand at Blossom. "I'm just getting it." "And you're wrong," she went on suddenly. "That's not what they're saying at all. They're saying nude in the house of the doomed. It's obvious." "But why would they say that?" Blossom cried shrilly. It's meaningless! She spun around to Peter. You can hear it too. They're saying food will be coming soon. Aren't they? Aren't they? Peter shook his head. It sounds like be careful in Oliver's room. What? Cried Blossom. But you're both wrong. They're saying nude in the house of the doomed, Lola insisted, because that's what we are. We're helpless in this crazy place. Or at least they want us to think we're helpless. You just think it's food because that's all you ever think about. Stop saying things like that, Blossom shouted, stamping her foot. Stop being mean to me. Just remember, you said a couple of things this morning that I could always tell a few certain... What? Lola stepped towards her. What the hell are you talking about, you? She was interrupted by voices from above and hurrying footsteps. It isn't, Oliver was saying. Can't you hear them? They're saying she gobbled him up in the womb. No, it's the dish ran away with the spoon, said Abigail, sounding out of breath. It really is, Oliver. Of course, the correct interpretation is she gobbled him up in the womb.
Yes. Yeah, that's great. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, so the head scientist at the end of the book. So there are a bit of a reveal. There are evil scientists behind this. And the lead scientist reveals that it was just a string of nonsense gobbledygook. And so the idea is that there's so little kind of visual or auditory stimuli around them. Everything's so blank and so white that basically they'll kind of latch on to any possible stimulus that comes out and kind of interpret it or project all their emotions onto it willy-nilly. So most of these kind of make sense. So obviously Blossom very much is characterised as always wanting food. And so, yeah, of course, Lola's right that she thinks it's food will be coming soon because she's always thinking about food. Lola has this very pessimistic reading of the situation. So that's why she thinks it's nude in the house of the doomed. Peter, meanwhile... becomes kind of fixated on Oliver, and
yes, but Oliver's definitely less charming than he at first appears.
Yeah, absolutely. So that subtext, I guess, is be careful in Oliver's room. However, I mean, the dish ran away with the spoon. I guess Abigail is kind of sort of a bit head in the clouds, maybe?
Yeah, I think
dreamy?
She's a bit... Yeah. I think that's sort of what I got from it, that she's just sort of a little bit of a dreamer.
What about she gobbled him up in the womb?
Well, I have no idea about that.
No, same here. I've got no idea.
I mean, it's great, but... Who knows?
I mean, it definitely shows the dark depths to Oliver's personality.
Yeah.
You're all wrong. Of course it's that. It's logical. What else would it be?
It makes perfect sense, yeah.
Personally, it's my catchphrase.
Yeah.
So, should we focus a bit on... Oliver and Blossom, because they're definitely the central, well, really, to be fair, the adult scientists are the central antagonists, since they're the one who have devised this awful manipulative experiment.
Yes.
But for the purposes of plot, ostensibly, Oliver and Blossom are the antagonists. So should we start with Oliver?
Yeah. So... Oliver very much comes into the situation sort of wanting to take up the leadership role. When he first appears, he's sort of... Lola's off doing something. Oh, she's trying to find a toilet, which she does. But Oliver appears and he starts sort of doing a little song and dance and getting everyone laughing.
It's a very strange song and dance. Oliver's tendency towards kind of troubling gobbledygook starts quite early. Because I've written down his song.
Oh, good.
Which goes, I don't quite know the tune, but happy little sunshine, baby boo, gurgly goo, boopity boo, strange flowers growing in my garden of love, my garden of love, love, love. Cue electric guitar. I don't.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd be merrily laughing along if someone was singing that.
Yeah, they're all really into it. They're all like, oh, brilliant, Japes. I love it, Oliver. Great stuff. You're the leader for us.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, like Lola gets back and she's unhappy that they're having fun. Well, she thinks they should be taking this a lot more seriously. And it sort of starts this rivalry between Oliver and Lola, where he's very used to being able to charm girls, and Lola's immune to his charm, so he's quite uncomfortable about that. Whereas Abigail is sort of entirely under his spell from the moment they meet.
Yeah, I've just been watching, perhaps against my better judgment, Always Sunny in Philadelphia with my sister. I don't know if you... Have you seen much of it?
I haven't seen it.
So, I mean, it's basically like Seinfeld, but the characters are all wholly, horribly reprehensible human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And Oliver is very... strikes me as very similar, a young version of the character of Dennis in Always Sunny, who is basically a sociopath. And likes to charm women just so he can get the sense of power over them. But we just watched an episode where, to get revenge on one of his friends, he tries to sleep with his various friends' mothers, and none of them are attracted to him. And over the course of the episode, he becomes more and more distressed by this, and the idea that these older women don't want to sleep with him. It is so outside of his comprehension and his self-image that his sort of ego crumbles over the course of the episode until he's basically having a full-on existential crisis. you get the sense that Oliver is just not prepared for a girl of his age to not find him attractive, and is just completely thrown by this.
And he also has Peter very much in his thrall, because we'll talk more about this, but he reminds Peter of a boy who he used to idolize, and he used to protect him in one of the state homes he used to live in. So there's also this kind of, I don't know, it's not sexual, but sort of romantic undertones of how the relationship between Peter and Oliver, although Oliver only wants power, really.
Yes, I mean, I think Oliver kind of becomes Peter's attachment figure, basically. But it feels like it's romantic on Peter's part. He certainly talks about love. But he's also characterised as very kind of innocent and naive compared to the other characters. And so it's not necessarily sexualised. But as we said in Interstellar Pig, that despite the fact that these are, you know, mid to older teenagers, generally speaking, sex is not particularly to the fore in Sleater, to be honest.
Yeah, and it's sort of kind of suggested that this is a function of the world that they live in, where they're all in very strictly sex-segregated state homes, where it's been taught that, I don't know, men and women can't have anything to do with each other, or that anything they do have to do with each other is inherently sexual, I think.
Yes, I like that the correlative of this is that it also devalues platonic male-female friendships, of course. So by the end, Peter and Lola even though the suggestion, implicitly at least, might be that they're of queer sexualities, perhaps. So yeah. it's understated, but that's the impression you get, but have formed a friendship and are shown holding hands at the end as friends. And I liked this idea of the kind of platonic friendship as an act of resistance against this regime. Yeah. I thought it was quite interesting. And not something you see that much of in modern young adult dystopian fiction, which the relationships are perhaps more romantic. But anyway, so Oliver's one of the antagonists. The other one is Blossom, and William Sleater doesn't like Blossom.
Yes, he emphatically doesn't like Blossom. Or, I think it's fair to say, fat people in general.
Yeah, and we kind of touched on this briefly. It doesn't really come up particularly in Interstellar Pig. There's perhaps a certain idolisation of thin people, but there isn't much about fat people. But there certainly is here.
Oh, yes.
Did you keep a tally?
Yeah, I did. There's almost too much to mention, really. Sort of every time Blossom comes up, someone's talking about how fat she is in one way or another. Either just literally calling her fat, or the sort of descriptions of her whenever she's in the scene. But for example, when we first meet her, her features seem small, lost in mounds of pink flesh, and her body jiggled underneath the white ruffles of her dress as she pressed herself backwards against a flight of steps. There's lots of descriptions like that about... Well, see, I was thinking about this. I just think that Blossom... There's just a lot more descriptions of Blossom's body than of anyone else's body.
Oh, by a long way. Like, it seems almost like the narrative is kind of fixated on Blossom's body.
Yeah.
It's very odd. And kind of linking Blossom's body with abjection, right? Which I guess, you know, isn't a new thing in terms of fat shaming. But it is very overstated, right? So there's an emphasis on Blossom's dress being dirty. Mm-hmm. And, you know, presumably, you know, there are no showers here. And, you know, it's all very sweaty and such. So, you know, presumably all of their clothes are dirty. But we don't really get descriptions of the rest of their clothes. However, yes. Blossom's dress, which starts out white, ends up, you know, being described as, you know, sort of... You know, sweat marked and filthy and ragged.
Her filthy dress hanging on her like a shroud.
Yeah. I see, it sort of goes beyond being offensive to being kind of concerning.
It's just relentless. And sort of to the extent that even when Lola and Peter are, like, starving to death and they're just sort of sitting kind of motionless, like, trying to conserve as much energy as possible, you know, and, like, the others sort of sneak up on them, and, like, Lola sort of taps Peter on the shoulder and's like... and, like, says something about how, oh, it didn't take long for Blossom to get fat again.
Yeah, they're clinging on to their life, literally at death's door, and they're like, must insult Blossom's weight.
I was reading sort of stuff that... Kiefer Bay on Twitter sort of writes a lot about fat studies and things, and he's been talking about the horror of corporeality and how that's specifically there in our reaction to fatness. Like, if we're thin enough, we can pretend that we don't have fallible human bodies that get sick and betray us, and fat people are like an affront to that sense of immortality kind of thing. And I think that Blossom is sort of getting quite a lot of that in this book.
Yeah, it's hard because, you know, it's tricky, and I guess perhaps especially when we're talking about a gay author, so Sleeta's gay, or was, he's dead now. You know, I don't feel wholly comfortable getting into kind of psychoanalysing him.
Mm-hmm.
But to a certain extent, there does seem to be a certain discomfort with talking about sexuality, right, in Sleeta's books. This is something Adam Kadrey's sort of mentioned in his sort of survey of essentially all of Sleeta's fiction. It's something I've noticed that, and yeah, it's young adult fiction, but there are times, so for instance, there's a lot of kissing between Oliver and Abigail.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's very odd because Oliver is written as though he has kind of sexual desires and as though he might be, you know, quite a predatory figure, basically. Mm. Yet there's never any indication that he even thinks of pushing this further than kissing at all. That sexuality beyond kissing doesn't really seem to exist in this world.
Yeah, and what, even, you know, when it's Blossom, Abigail and Oliver, and they've fallen into this routine of tormenting each other to receive food, there's never any sexual element to that at all.
No, there's never any kind of sexual threat, which, yeah, I can understand, you know, it's a young adult book. I'm not saying it shouldn't necessarily be there, and it might just be that it would be there in something like The Hunger Games, right?
Yeah.
That perhaps I'm more used to modern young adult dystopian fiction, which probably would bring that in. Mm-hmm. But it, I don't know, there is something there, I think, about Sleeta being not wholly comfortable with talking about sexuality in the body. And it does feel like, yeah, there's a lot of kind of displacement onto the figure of Blossom, basically.
Yeah, she just is a lot more, her physicality is just mentioned a lot more than any other character.
A lot of focus on her tongue as well. Yeah. And not necessarily sexualizing that, but there is a lot of descriptions of Blossom's tongue and what her tongue looks like.
Yeah. It's not just her fat, it's sort of all of her gets a lot of scrutiny.
And described in a much more sensory way, I think, than the rest of the book. It's a real shame because otherwise I think it's a pretty great piece of dystopian fiction. But I have to say that, you know, if you would be triggered by kind of demonization of fatness, then you shouldn't be reading it, or I'd seriously advise against it, because I think it would be really anger-inducing, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's also the very basic, simplistic thing going on with Blossom, that her fatness is sort of representing the excesses of the corrupt government, because her parents, unlike the other characters, her parents only died very recently. Until then, she was sort of part of the elite, the upper class, and had the luxuries associated with that. Like, she's had real meat, and she lived in an actual house, and that sort of thing. So, I mean,
yeah,
I think it's not particularly clever.
No, it doesn't feel like a kind of rigorous engagement with the class system of this dystopia.
Yeah.
I mean, the dystopia is sort of always gestured towards, right? We never get a full sense of what life is like outside of this facility. Well, we get a few descriptions. So, as you just mentioned, Blossom lived in an actual house, or at least a house where one's family can live, whereas everyone else seems to live in some kind of collectivist tenement housing.
Yes, residential megastructures.
Like in a sort of J.G. Ballard dystopia, I guess.
Yeah, so I did like how you get just hints of the dystopia. I think that was done pretty well. Peter says his father died in the war, and Lola replies, same as everybody else. So there's been a war. Lots of orphans. They're not unusual in being orphans, I think. They're in like strictly sex segregated state institutions that have a lot of surveillance, I think we get the impression.
Yeah, you certainly get the impression that the government doesn't have any qualms about human or civil rights. And has a lot of power.
Yeah. Something called electric eyes are mentioned in passing.
I think it's quite a good way of, in a way, doing a dystopia, sort of focusing on this kind of micro environment and then gesturing towards the rest of it, because it kind of means you don't get... I mean, some people really like extensive world building. If I'm honest, it's something that, you know, I struggled, for instance, reading Dune, because so much of it was just world building, and I struggle after a while, to be honest. Whereas, you know, I think you definitely understand what kind of dystopia this is without it going into great detail.
Yeah, I think it's good. I like that about it. It's interesting how you pick it up as it goes along. And oh yeah, the cars have gas masks because the air near the highway is unbreathable.
I didn't pick that bit up.
Yeah, because Lola, this Lola's quite a rebel. She stole a car and then crashed it.
16 years old and already stealing cars.
And then she had to sort of... She was sort of trying to flag down help on the side of the highway, but she had to keep going back to the car to get breaths of breathable air.
And there are times where it also seems like the facility sounds like a reality TV show, which is odd because obviously this was written a couple of decades before reality TV shows really existed.
Kept reminding me of this psychological TV experiment thing I saw where they had just a group of people in a room and there was a counter like sort of fixed on the wall that was kind of ticking forward sometimes, and it sort of the people in the room got increasingly preoccupied with trying to work out what they were doing that was making this counter tick forwards or not, and like in the end it was revealed that it was just it was just ticking forward based on whether a goldfish in a tank in another room had swum to the other end of the tank or not. But presumably they
read into it in great detail.
I guess
it kind of, to a degree, illustrates how conspiracy theories come about, right? Humans are very good at seeing patterns where really there's just chaos. And then building on those patterns to create quite complex systems that may not actually be that rooted in reality, but end up being kind of internally consistent or self-stabilising.
Yeah.
So, texture of the week.
Texture of the week.
we definitely need some kind of radio stab.
Oh, see if Mackie wants to do us a little...
With some texture sounds. Do you have your Velcro?
Oh, yeah. Oh, can I?
All yeah. Right. Texture of the week. Nice.
As we were saying before we started recording, we timed this very awkwardly as this book has very few textures. And the ones it has are mostly not very pleasant.
Related to poor Blossom.
Yeah. But I chose the description of the stairs themselves, which is without railings, they rose and fell at alarming angles, forking, occasionally spiralling, rising briefly together, only to veer apart again, crossing over and below one another, connected at rare intervals by thin bridges spanning deep gulfs. Nothing supported them. The glossy white material from which they were made seemed to be strong enough to arch over great distances. Yeah, I think there's something quite interesting about that. This sort of ultra-strong, thin, glossy white material sort of stretching and arcing and spiralling around.
Like a film by your least favourite director, Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah.
My texture of the week was the food pellets, because they taste very richly of meat, but because they're kind of described as like pellets or capsules, I found it really hard to understand or imagine that. Like I couldn't picture whether they were like mini cocktail sausages or like those fish oil capsules, but with kind of liquid meat inside, or kind of like paracetamol that had a meat flavour. Yeah, I spent quite a bit of time just trying to work out what these were like, because I just couldn't imagine them. And, you know, having been vegetarian for so long, I can no longer imagine meat anyway. So, you know, there's a wholly within the realms of the phantasmagorical. I would be quite put. I mean, they're all very pleased with this, you know. Apparently they don't, you know, the food is pretty dire or bland in this dystopia, so they're all quite excited by the meat, but I think I would have sulked by not having a vegetarian alternative.
That's all they get to eat as well, but I mean, they don't seem to mind.
No, meat and water. To be fair, so, you know, I read some Goodreads reviews of this book, and one or two of the reviews said how, you know, the message of the book was about where we place value, and that, you know, the importance of kind of human integrity and valuing these inner aspects of ourselves over petty concerns like food. And I said, well, that's all well and good until you're, you know, actually starving. To be honest, like, even though, you know, we certainly are meant to read Oliver and Blossom, Peter, and Abigail. Critically, I mean, for, you know, for succumbing and eating the food.
Yes.
You know, I have to say, you know, reading it, I thought, well, you know, I'd like to think I'd be able to stick it out for quite a while, not succumbing to cruel behaviour. But, you know, people do underestimate, I think, the power of just those basic human needs.
Yeah, I mean, it's not much of a choice at all, you know.
Which is the whole point, really, of, you know, Beyond Freedom and Dignity, right? That classical conditioning, I think, is a scary approach to human psychology, because it's radically anti-free will, essentially. It's really depriving humans of choice, or saying that humans don't have choice, that they're just being conditioned for stimuli, so the best way to keep a population in order is to, you know, artificially induce certain behaviours through the use of stimuli. And, you know, this is a very pessimistic view, I think, of human behaviour. But it also does odd things to our understanding of morality, because if there is no free will, you know, are we able to morally condemn one another? But, yeah, I mean, you know, I've tried. I think it's very easy sometimes to kind of think, oh, yes, I'm superior to my basic human needs. But, you know, I've tried going without sleep for a few days. And, you know, but after 3 days, I was basically hallucinating. So it doesn't take that long.
No. And yeah, I mean, I think it struck me that that we're meant to think of particularly Oliver and Blossom as being very deliberately manipulative and sort of very clear about, that they're deliberately being terrible, really.
Oh yeah, and when we get a glimpse of their inner lives, they're, written essentially as having no compassion or empathy for any other human beings whatsoever. You know, they aren't really given a shred of redemptive qualities at all.
Which I don't know, I kind of thought was interesting because I mean I tend to think that that's not really how most people interact with the world, and that it's more the bad behavior is more likely to be of like not as deliberately set out like that, coming from different psychological and experiential roots and stuff.
I mean, I tend to feel that most bad behavior or abusive behavior comes from ignorance and fear and cognitive dissonance and people justifying unacceptable things to themselves, which at the time seems acceptable to them, otherwise they probably wouldn't do it. But you know, I'm sure there are exceptions. You know, there are people clearly who do revel in being awful and are quite aware of the fact that they're being very cruel and just don't care. And you know, there's the question of what behavioural aspects or character aspects have been taken into consideration when selecting these teenagers as test subjects.
Yes, that's true. Yes, because they were picking people out who they thought might be manipulated into becoming
Well,
spies,
soldiers, mercenaries,
soldiers,
something like that.
torturers, concentration camp guards, like.
So stooges of the government and its most fascistic impulses. And as we say, you know, they're all 16, they're all orphans, and also they all have phenomenally good balance.
The main twist of this book is that none of them fall off any of these alarming spiraling staircases and plunge to their death.
None of them fall off the toilet, which is perched in the middle of like a foot wide bridge or something ridiculous.
Sort of arching, incredibly narrow bridge. They have to some undetermined amount high up in the air.
Yeah, like if it's me in this book, it's just like day one in the House of Stairs house. Adam recoils in disgust at the meaty sausage pellet he's expected to eat, falls over backwards, and plummets to his death at the bottom of the stairs. You know, that'd be me gone. I wouldn't have an opportunity to test my morality, you know.
Didn't even make it to the toilet.
No, exactly. So, you know, however awful the behaviour of some of these characters is, you know, they've got to be commended for their balance, at least. Better than mine.
Chosen for their suspect morality and incredible parkour skills.
Oh no, that's a book I want to read. The morally compromised parkour runners. Any final thoughts on the book?
Well, we didn't quite get into the sort of queer subtext.
No, I mean,
it's not. There's not much there. But
no, I mean, I guess it mostly centres on Peter. So you can make an argument for the character of Lola as well, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I want to because I want to find queer women and things. I mean, there's no evidence, but just that she's tomboyish and Peter mistakes her for a boy at first, and Oliver's charms don't work on her very much. She has a certain vibe.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And it's nice that the two most heroic characters, the characters who have the greatest inner strength and dignity, are characters who are subtly coded as queer.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the less said about Blossom, the better.
Yeah, I think that's probably all I've really written down about this.
Well, you haven't heard my sign-off yet.
Oh, gosh, no, I haven't.
Because after last week's humiliating debacle, I decided to prepare one in advance.
Oh, yes.
So, listen to this. Keep it starey, spooky kids.
Oh, wow, Adam. Oh, yeah. You've outdone yourself.
Thank you. It makes it all worthwhile.
Yeah.
Life.
So if you want to keep it starey with us on Twitter, we're at StillScaredPod. Or you can email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com. Our theme music is by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music is by Jay Kelly. And our artwork is by Letty Wilson. And I'll put all of that in the show notes, as usual. I'll see you next time for I don't know what. We haven't got that far.
Neither do I. We'll see.
We'll see. All right. See you then.
Bye.